The author, Donald Miller, speaks of a lifeboat community. Imagine yourself on a lifeboat. And on that particular lifeboat, there's a few different sorts of people, tropes in our society. You've got a male lawyer. You got a female doctor. You got a garbage collector, a stay-at-home mom, and a disabled child. And for a while, this diverse group of people on the lifeboat get along fine until the supplies start to run out. And now you're faced with the question, who are you going to kick off the lifeboat? Who are you going to do it? Everybody else ties in their vote. It's all come down to you. Which sort of person would you kick off your little lifeboat community? The tragedy is, I don't think there's a right answer. I'm not going to sort it out. But what I am going to do is say this. I think all of us know a little bit about what it's like to live in lifeboat communities. We live in communities that mostly seem fine when things are going well. There's some give and take. We get something out of the community. But when resources become scarce, when the chaos threatens to overwhelm us, when there's some sort of challenge that we face in the community, it reveals itself for what it is, a lifeboat community. The sort of community where maybe everyone was really just in it for themselves all along, where the alliances were more about what we could do for one another than what you could do for me than what I could do for you. The lifeboat communities, we know that we are in communities that are dog-eat-dog, that are thinking about when it's going to be time to put somebody out. And that somebody might just be us. But my guess is this. We don't all of us live day to day in this sort of cutthroat reality, right? More of us, I think, live, rather than lifeboat communities, in ghostly communities. We've got an upstairs ghost in our house. We call him that. I remember the day when I was downstairs. My son Malcolm was upstairs watching Paw Patrol. We were the only two people in the house. And I heard the water running upstairs. And I figured, well, Malcolm is potty trained. He's probably just running the water upstairs. And then I hear his little voice at the top of the stairs. Dad, are you in there? What? I run upstairs as quickly as I can. They're at a pretty steep angle. And I go into the bathroom, and the hot water in the bathroom is on as hard as it will go. And no one had done it. Periodically, upstairs, our lights will turn on and off all by themselves. You can blame the faulty wiring if you're that sort of boring person, or you can blame the upstairs ghost. The upstairs ghost is a presence, but he's really insubstantial. We don't see him often. Rarely does he make himself or herself, for that matter, known. He's not a big disruption in our life. No one's ever been pushed down the stairs by the upstairs ghost. Mostly, he's insubstantial and irrelevant to our lives. Except when I tell stories about him for sermon illustrations. The upstairs ghost is characteristic of a ghostly community. It's one where we're there, we're a presence, but we float in and out. And nobody would really notice if we were gone. And no one would really care if we were. And we don't really know how to change that at all. We don't know how to make meaningful, substantial communities. What sort of community life characterizes you? Do you live in lifeboat communities? Do you live in ghostly communities? A lot of times I think that our ghostly communities are a result of our fear of lifeboat communities. We're afraid of getting in to a dog-eat-dog world where somebody might get hurt. And so we keep things light and fluffy and insubstantial. We have lots of digital activity, but very real fleshly community activity. And what I want to say is this. But this text shows us that Nehemiah's community is a radically different sort of community. It's the sort of lifeboat that pulls people on instead of kicking people off. It's the sort of community that is substantial as opposed to insubstantial, that matters, that has a real presence to it. Nehemiah's community, or the community that God is creating through Nehemiah, is a godly community. It's marked by mutuality, a unique methodology, and a mission together. Let's look at each of these in turn. First, the concept of mutuality. This is a community that knows and needs one another. The first thing you notice when you read chapter 3 of the book of Nehemiah is all the names. You can't help but get past it. And for us, that's super boring. We don't know any of these things, any of these names at all. Who is Zadok, the son of Bana? We can't even pronounce it. It seems pointless to us, right? But if you could put yourself in the shoes of the people who are hearing this letter read out loud for the first time, you would have a radically different experience. When they were talking about this community, you could insert maybe some names that you personally would have known. Then Matt built this part of the wall. Then Casey, then Lindsay, then Martin, then Emma built this part of the wall. They knew each other deeply and substantially. They knew each other's names. And I don't know what sort of people you remember their names, but I'll tell you this. It's hard for me to remember the names of people who will not be useful to me, who won't have some sort of substantial impact on my life. That's not a good thing. I'm not saying be like me, but is that maybe true of you? That if we hear all these names, really what it means, I think, is that they knew one another deeply. If you had read this in context, these names would have been meaningful because of their relationship to one another. The second thing you got to realize is this: they know each other, but they also need each other. If you read the whole chapter of the book, chapter 3, what you start to realize is this. This refrain comes up over and over again. So-and-so built the wall in front of his house. So-and-so built the wall in front of her house. And on around the territory where the wall had been broken down. People repaired the wall in front of their own houses. Do you get what that means? If somebody didn't do their job, and there was a big hole in the wall, the whole wall itself becomes pointless. It becomes irrelevant. The barbarians can get in whenever they want. That's the weak point. So in this place, everybody who's involved in Nehemiah's wall building project needs everybody else. Their destiny, their identity is inextricably linked. If you were to walk over the 100-plus acres of Fish Lake National Park, you would be walking under the white trunks, golden leaves, and deep blue Utah sky of an aspen grove. 40,000 individual trees jutting up from the ground. The pictures of this place are beautiful in fall. It's called the Pando. And you could walk under 40,000 trees, but you'd be walking on top of the second largest living organism on earth. See, all of these trees, though seemingly individual, are connected under the ground. They're part of the same root system extending over 100-plus acres. Did you know that it's only the second largest living thing on the face of the earth? There's a honey fungus, whatever that is, in Oregon that covers 9 square miles. That one's free. I'm here all week. We are connected. We don't realize it. I think our community now, both Christ the King and more broadly, is a lot like that tree, that grove of trees. It's a lot like the wall building community of Nehemiah. We seem like individuals, you know, buried under the dirt. We are connected. Our identities are yoked to one another. We bring different things to one another. We are not independent. We are interdependent. And that's the case. And that's the case for this community of Nehemiah. Christianity has for a long time seemed to be all about you. You can actually see it even in this building, some of this horrific, pernicious influence. You notice if you thought about what your favorite or your least favorite part of this room is, what would you say? Answer me. What's your least favorite part of this room? The carpet. Yes. The carpet is terrible. And there's something human in you that rebels against the carpet. You know why the carpet was put here? The carpet was put here to dampen sound. So that when you worshiped, you couldn't hear other people's voices, because Christian worship was a private individual experience. Isn't that interesting? I love this building, but we gonna rip out the carpet. Y'all, because we are connected to one another, and worship ought to embody that, just like the rest of our life ought to embody that. Christianity is not just about you. It's about bringing you into a community through which God will work. It's still true for all of us. It's just not as obvious. One of the challenges
of this sort of connection now in our modern day is that we live far apart from one another, and the connections between one of us are a lot less obvious, you know? Some of you maybe live in Pooler, some of you live in Parkside, some of you live on the islands. You can go a whole day without seeing one another, much less needing one another. You don't need one another for food or for medicine or anything like that. It's like that part is hard. It's hard to need one another nowadays. And so I think what Nehemiah's community demonstrates for us is that we have to choose what would have come naturally to us at one point in time. We actually have to choose to need one another. We have to choose to give our gifts to one another, because it's still true that we are connected. If you don't bring your gifts to the community, if you don't build the section of the wall in front of your house, then that tool in the arsenal is eliminated. The weapon is lost. The wall isn't finished. The barbarians get in. But maybe even harder than bringing your gifts to the community is bringing your needs. To bring the thing that you want but don't have and lay it at the feet of other people who might could serve you that way. Because if you don't bring your needs, then other people's gifts don't get put to use. What if ministry to one another isn't telling one another how to be, but instead being willing to give the gift of needing one another? What if that's what it means to be a good neighbor and a good Christian? Not just to tell your neighbors how it is, but to be willing to expose the connection that is there all along, but that we forget. What if it's being willing to need one another? The reality is this: people that have it all together are always the most boring friends, because no struggle is ever shared with one another. Well, we can't become a community, but we can become the sort of people who make that kind of community. How? What sort of virtue do we have to cultivate in order to become a community of mutuality? It's going to be tough, because in America, we have the Declaration of Independence, not the Declaration of Interdependence. We are taught not to need, because if you need things, you're a burden. And even bringing gifts is actually hard, because it means committing yourself to a particular place in order to pour out those gifts. It means giving up on a lot of other options. You're making yourself vulnerable to being asked. How do we become the sort of people who can participate in communities of mutuality? The answer that this community gives us, the methodology, is humility. Humility is never the first thing you notice. It never is. Because humility is having a truthful estimation of yourself and its relative importance to the world. We think of humility, I think, a lot of times as somebody talking about how bad they are. That's not humility. That's arrogance. It's the display of the arrogant knowledge that you know and nobody else does how bad you are. It's not humility. You will not notice humility. Arrogance overestimates your importance to the community or the story. Shame underestimates your importance to the story, but humility truthfully estimates your importance to the story. You never notice humility. You have to be really paying attention, and that's true in Nehemiah chapter 3. What comes up, what marks this community, is actually a willingness to set aside their own agendas for the sake of the community. It's basically humble. And if you read the whole chapter, you would see it over and over again. Even in the text that we just read, they lay aside their family allegiances in order to do the work. This is not some tribal clan warfare, family against family. That's not what's going on here. They put that aside. They put their family aside to build the wall for the sake of the city. They leave aside where they're from, maybe harder for some of us than for others, to build the kingdom of God. They leave aside their craft to build this wall. Verse 8 is really fun. If you get to it and read it carefully, I don't think you have it there, but it starts identifying different trades and abilities of people, and they leave that stuff aside and they just do this work on the wall. Notice I didn't say they left their personality aside, but they did leave aside their craft and the trade. It mentions goldsmiths and in particular perfumers who are working on the wall, people who have left aside their job and are going to do this thing for the sake of the community. And I don't have it in the Bible. I can't prove it to you. This is purely Soren speculation. But I like to think that there was a perfumer building the section of the wall and that section of the wall was a little bit extra. Okay? Can we just say that it was? You can see the perfumer coming out of his house and being like, this wall is janky. It needs a little glitter. Come on, we're going to fix it. You know what I'm saying? Like, they left their jobs, not their personality, right? It's the wall and the only section with some glitter. They left aside their trade, their merchant. It mentions merchants who were out there building the wall. They left aside the opportunity to do money, to join in with the sake of the community, to make money. They even left aside their callings. There's no sense in this text that the priests and the holy men get to sit out the work that the community is engaged in. Verse 1, verse 17, verse 26, verse 9, all these verses that illustrate that the priests and holy guys got to get their hands dirty too for the sake of the community. Even they leave aside their gender, verse 12, even the daughters of somebody work. They leave aside their class. There are rich people who get down on their knees right beside poor people to do the work. They are humble enough to leave aside their agenda for the sake of the life of the community. Contrast that with the nobles that you see in verse 5. And next to them, the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles wouldn't stoop to serve the Lord. If you saw somebody not doing the work of building the community, how would you react? When you encounter that in your own life, somebody not giving 100% to the life of the community, how does it make you feel? What do you want to do? Do you want to get after them? Do you want to complain? Do you want to give up your own work because nobody else is chipping in? You know what's interesting? The people of Tekoa did not spend all their time thinking about the nobles of Tekoa. In fact, there is one group of people who builds two sections of wall. It's the common folk of Tekoa. It's like they looked at their nobles, and instead of complaining, they just got to work doing twice as much. That right there is true humility. Booker T. Washington, the famous African-American educator, had just become the president of the Tuskegee Institute. He's famous. And as he walked through this town in Alabama, he walked through an affluent neighborhood, and a white lady stopped him. And she said, how'd you like to make a couple dollars chopping some wood in my backyard? She didn't recognize Mr. Washington. How would you respond? Do you know who I am? You know. Here's how he responded. He chopped the wood and took a couple dollars. And after she said, thanks so much, who are you? He told her. And she was deeply ashamed for having done it. She realized something about herself. She apologized profusely, and here's what he said. He said, it's all right. I enjoy a little manual labor, especially when done for the sake of a friend. This lady would go on to become the biggest donor to the Tuskegee Institute in its early years. She was shocked, and community between the two of them was built, not by insisting on their rights and privileges, but on laying aside their rights and privileges to serve one another. Can we do that? Could we be that sort of community here? What would it take to lay aside family, town, craft, trades, callings, gender, class, to do the work? Not saying that any of those things are unimportant, not saying that at all, but to do the work of serving one another. We have been taught to pursue our dreams. I had my friends and I in college had a little game we would play when somebody was going to offer an excuse for how to get out of something that we were doing as a community. We had called it playing various cards. I don't know if you had this. And there was always discussion over which cards trumped what other cards? You know, the family card excuse. Sometimes you'd play the family card to get out of roommate meal or whatever. Sometimes you'd play the girlfriend card excuse. Sometimes you'd play the schoolwork excuse. The biggest excuse of all was the God card. You know, like, oh, playing the God card. Nobody can argue with that one. It trumps everything. Some of our most heated discussions were in debates over which card trumped which one. Was a girlfriend card a reason to get out of roommate meal? The jury's still out on that one. We've sort of been taught, though, I think in America, to pursue our dreams, and the job card is probably pretty paramount, isn't it? It's really hard to think about being a merchant and stopping making money for a little while. We, all of us, believe in the capital economy and the primacy of that. It's really important to us. But Jesus does something else. A godly community does something else. It values something else as ultimate, even though craft, trade, calling is good. It demands that we ask not what can I get out of the community of faith, but what can I give to it? And that, ironically, is the only way to keep from being exhausted. Because if you are asking, what can I get out of life? What can I achieve? Then you will be worn out. You will be. Because there will always be something more to get out. Always. It will never stop. But if you start to ask the question, what can I give in humility to the people of God? Something different happens. You recognize that you are not the sort of person who has to save the world. That there is a limit, actually, ironically, to what you can give. That you're free from the relentless pursuit of other stuff. And it puts you on the train tracks of God's grace. It actually puts you in a community where other people are asking the same thing. What can I give to this community? If mutuality is the goal, then the methodology is humility. We've got to become humble people. How? How is that? We're going to need a big enough story to decenter us. Out of all the new words we've been introduced to over the last maybe 6 months or so, my favorite, and I think the most useful, is the concept of decentering a particular perspective. To decenter that perspective means to put it in the context of broader events that are going on. It's like there's a bigger story out there happening than simply the perspective on offer. I remember a time when I got decentered. We were in the backyard. I think I was nine. It was the summer of 1995, and my dad was throwing the football with me. And I was telling him about my life and my day and this sort of thing when the sliding door opened in the backyard, and my mom stuck her head out and she screamed, "Rabin has been assassinated!" I don't know if you know who Yitzhak Rabin is. He was the Israeli prime minister at the time. But I do remember what happened. Soren got decentered. Dad dropped the football and ran inside. You know, will this mean war? Because one story was bigger than the other, or so he thought. I think I've gotten to the point now where I would decenter Rabin. Nehemiah's community wasn't just there building the walls. It wasn't just political. It wasn't just self-preservation. That was a part of it, but not all of it. Because they were risking themselves. They were willing to decenter themselves for the sake of something better. They had a story that was big enough that self-preservation wasn't their only goal. What was that story? Their story was the glory of God. You saw it right there in the first chapter, or chapter 2, the first couple of verses. "Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer suffer derision. And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good." Jerusalem is the place where God lives, where God's name is. It's the thing that brings Him glory. When people see it, they're supposed to go, "Wow, God lives there." And here it is with its walls turned down, and these people wanted to change it. They cared more, if I could put an anachronism in there, they cared more about how Jesus looked than they did about how they looked. I was in Germany for the World Cup in 2006 on a train, and this young German guy sat down next to me, or across from me, figured out I was an American. I wasn't super patriotic. I don't walk around with the flag on a lot of the time. And at first it was really cool. You know, I was talking to the locals. We were, you know, kind of mixing it up. He spoke a little English. And I cared about being cool. I wanted to seem like the urbane traveler, you know, who knew his way around. So I was doing that stupid thing I do where I try to talk in the accent of the people who were talking to me. And then this guy started talking about gangsters. I said, "Have you seen any gangsters in America?" And I hadn't moved to Savannah yet, so I said, "No." He was on and on about the gangsters. Are they on every block? Are they on every street corner? And finally, you know, I got tired. I didn't care about seeming urbane anymore. I kind of just wanted to punch him in the face. I got a little jealous for America. I'm like, "It's not all gangsters, bro." You know, like, I cared more about how America looked than I did about how I looked in that moment. He got up awkwardly and left. He's walking around confused to this day, wondering about all the gangsters in America. And I think something like that has got to begin happening for us. We've got to become the sort of people who care more about how Jesus looks to the world than how we look to the world, you know? Well, it's going to make us awkward. It's going to make us nerdy. It's going to make us give up successful things. That's true, you know, it's true. But here's the thing. If you care about how you look the most, you will never have the humility to bring your needs to the church. You won't want to look weak. But if you care about how Jesus looks, then to bring your needs to the church is actually a gift to the world. Because it shows the world where the grace of God is found, with the people of God, where mercy is found. Your weaknesses, the things you most want to leave at home, those are your gifts that Jesus is using. If you care about how you look, you'll never have the humility to stay in the church. Because it's a place of acceptance, a place of rest. You're going to loathe it because it's not a proving ground. And that will be boring to you. It'll be boring to you. You'll need to go somewhere else to prove yourself over and over again. And then you'll deprive the church of the strengths you could have given, the needs you could have met. If you care how Jesus looks, you give your gifts to the church, not because it's cool, but because it's Christ. You know? And then a funny thing happens, and I'll close with this. When you glorify God, He glorifies you. The people, the names on this list of Nehemiah, the whole chapter, they probably had really complex lives, you know. They probably were sinners. We know that they were. They had all sorts of dysfunction in their lives. They were broken. Some of them probably drank too much. Some of them were cheaters. Some of them were liars. Some of them were thieves. You know, I'm sure that that was the case because they were humans like all of us. But you notice what gets recorded about them in this text? You notice? It actually doesn't get any of that. We don't get any of that details. And I think that's on purpose. Because I think these names are not just names from the past. They're also a glimpse into our future. That as we, God's people, strive to build His kingdom and strive to become a community of mutuality, this is actually how the book of life records your names. You know, they talk again about another book with a bunch of names in it, right? It's at the end of the story in Revelation. And there's a book of life with a bunch of names in it, the names of the family, the sons and daughters of God. And I think this is how it gets recorded. Not that they were perfect, not that they did everything, not that they were sinless, but that it was enough. That they did enough. That they were loved by God, redeemed by Jesus. This is how your name will look one day. It's true for us as individuals. It's true for our community with all its failings. Remembered about them that they did their part. You know, as I looked sort of out here, it's easy to... The people who are going to feel guilty about the sermon are the wrong people who are going to feel guilty about it. Because when you hear a sermon about giving to the community, it's the people who already do. And as I look out here, it's like, you guys showing up here, and actually in many ways, is the beautiful thing. The work it's sort of done. Like, you're the family that comes and gives and participates, you know? And so what I hope that you take from this is not some sense of do more, you know, God's mad at you. But instead, my hope is that you take this as both a call to live holy in our community, but also as the good news that the well done is coming and that your names are there written in the book of life. That's the good news for you. When Jesus returns, he's not mad, but he sees brothers, sisters, sons, and daughters. And we rely on that and we trust in it. Let's pray together. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for this family. We thank you for a community committed to building the wall, to building your kingdom, not just the church, although the church is a big part of that, but also your kingdom in the world. We ask for the courage and the strength to do it, the strength to bring our needs to one another, the hope that those needs might be met by the grace of Jesus coming out in our community, in our body, in our fellowship. We ask that your Spirit would dwell among us to empower this sort of living. And we ask it in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.